Well, Guy Meldrum had a furniture store on Court Street, and he had a delivery horse that was very lazy, and this Mr. Foss had a, they always had him trimmed up in nice shape and a nice harness on him, and Mr. Meldrum used to deliver with this horse, and Mr. Foss rode around till he met him one day, and he hit him up to swap. Well, of course, the horse that Mr. Foss had was all fixed up in good shape, and finally Melvin was taken with him, and he says, "How will you trade?" Well, he says, "I told my wife this morning I wouldn't trade unless I got $50. Well, Meldrum says he'd give him the $50. This is a true story, too. And then he takes the horse that he got from Meldrum down. He had stalls in Tabor's barn. In those days, in the winter, they used to clip quite a lot of them because their hair got long and they'd sweat and get cold. So he takes the horse he got from Mr. Melvin down and clips him and puts a nice shiny harness on him and so forth. It was quite cold. And he drove around until he met Mr. Melvin. This was on the same day. And he says, "Well, now look, Guy, this is the horse you should have had." And Meldrum was greatly taken with him. And then Meldrum asked him his age, and he says, "Well, the man I got him from is a very truthful man. He said he was 8 years old. And will he stand?" And the man that I got him from guaranteed that he would. So, well, Mr. Melvin was quite taken with him, and he says, "Well, how will you trade again?" Well, he says, "I'll go and buy my $50. Mr. Melvin gave him the $50. Well, he delivered a while with that horse, and he lived up on Haywood Street and had quite a big barn. Well, as he started to go home, he got up along on Millistrad Street, and the horse turned right into Kelvin Street, and he didn't think much of that. And he got up along to where he turned into Haywood Street, and the horse went in there. Well, he was kind of surprised. Well, he got home and got up by his house, and the horse went in there. He was kind of surprised then. Well, then he got into the barn. There were four stalls in this barn, and they were all empty. And he took the harness off of the horse, and like a shot, the horse left and went into his own stall that he had left in the morning. And that was the first time during the day that Guy was convinced that he'd paid $100 to have his own horse clipped. Well, then the next day, that spread like wildfire around the square and everything, and about the next day, nearly everybody in town dropped in on Guy and wanted to know if he didn't want to swap horses. There was always some stunt like that, someone getting trimmed, and it was a great joke in those days, because we didn't have so many things to take up our attention.
Shouldn't put that in.
Who had the first car in Holton, and what was the reaction of the local people?
The first car in Holton was a Winton. It was owned by a man by the name of Getchell, who was an engineer on the B&A. Well, when he came with that, it was a great event for some of us to be picked up and given a ride in it. But it got so that you hardly hated to go out with him, because every time you met a horse, there'd be a horse taken for the field. They were scared to death of it. Well, anyway, it developed that he would announce in the morning, have it announced. And finally he did put a schedule in the Pioneer and the Times, the time each day during the week that he would be out with that horse. Well, that went along.
With that car,
I should say. Be out with that car. Well, I remember Dr. Ward had a very beautiful driving horse, and that horse was scat to death of that. Well, Dr. Ward didn't want to part with the horse, and if someone was sick, he couldn't wait till this fellow's hours were up. And there was a famous horseman here by the name of Al Howard, and he was quite a hand to handle balky horses and so forth. So Dr. Ward got Al Howard to take his horse and make a business several times a day of meeting this car. And he finally got that horse who trained so he paid no attention to it. Well, that gave everybody a lot of courage that they could finally get the horse so they wouldn't be afraid of this car. But that car, it was an old steamer, you know, made quite a lot of noise, and the horses were very much afraid of it.
What year was that, the first car?
If I remember correctly, it was about 1910 that we had the first car here. Well, then after that, shortly after that, Charlie Berry got a carload of Fords in, and then the car business was going. And I well remember there was a taxi fella by the name of Charlie Niles, had an old horse, and ran in those days, it was 10 cents. You'd ride anywhere all around town for 10 cents. So he finally sold this horse and bought a Ford from Charlie Berry. Well, Charlie spent a lot of time getting him going, and Charlie never could, for several days, couldn't get on to really driving, stopping it. Well, then it got so that he would go out with it, and then when he wanted to stop it, he'd swing down to Charlie Berry's and get Charlie to stop the car for him. I'll never forget what a joke they made of that.
As a boy, what was your basic meat supply during the year, and did you do your own butchering?
Well, a lot of people in the country here did do their own butchering. They'd have a steer a couple years old and so forth. But I remember that my own father, we always had a pig or two that we killed, and this salt pork was put away in the cellar. But the beef he used to buy every few days at the local markets, generally from a market run by a man by the name of Jim Gillen. But, of course, those time of markets are all gone. And it was quite a problem buying meat from some of the markets. I well remember there was a famous ball player here by the name of Biddo Wyatt. He was a great character. And Biddo became very famous. He was a French fellow, as a ball player, and got into the New England League. Well, they had a celebration, and that wasn't the right thing for Biddo, and he never got over the celebration. He came back home, and he started a little meat market. And I remember going in one day, and there laid 1/4 of beef. And I says to Biddo, "Do you have to have many quarters?" "Oh, no, there's right up on the wall there. That tells the kind of meat I get." "Well," he says, I says, "what do you mean?" "Well," he says, "I've got those knives marked, sharp and dull and so forth. And when you come in and you want very tender meat, I take that sharpest knife, and they see me cut with it, and they're satisfied." So we had pretty smart people in those days.
What medical facilities were available to you as a young boy? Did you make abundant use of home remedies, and can you remember some of these?
Well, we had good doctors then. They had no conveniences at all. And I well remember, of course, Dr. Donald, Dr. Carey, and a little later, Dr. Williams. And I have very good reason for remember them, for I ran a series of broken legs. I broke my leg when I was 6, 7, and then I skipped 8 and broke it again in 9, and right in my hip. In those days, they had no facilities whatsoever except their feeling of the bone. Well, each time, the first two times, I had Dr. Donald, And then he died, and the last time, Dr. Williams. That every time that happened, I was flat on my back, as can be, for 4 months. And the doctors did wonderful jobs. And they had no way of telling anything except for their feeling and putting splints on and all of that stuff. And for 4 months each time, you weren't allowed to be left alone a minute when you were asleep, because with it being right in my hip, I can remember Dr. Donald telling them over and over that if I went to sleep and twisted any, it would go out of place. And every night for 4 months, there was someone set up, and that was Dr. Donald's orders.
What were the home remedies?
Well, I wouldn't hardly tell just what the home remedies were, but back in those days, it was, the doctor would go to the drugstore and get you what he wanted you to take. And I never knew just what it was, but I remember that he used to give me something that would make me sleep. But they were wonderful doctors. I remember after this had gone about 5 or 6 years, the last time I broke it, Dr. Donald had died. Dr. Williams said it. They had a medical convention here, and this was quite a while after that. They had gotten the X-ray, and Dr. Williams had told them about these three breaks in the same place, and I remember he had me go in, and they took a picture of it, and they found that he and Dr. Donald had placed it so they got a perfect union and no twist in it. And that was a great, in those days, it was a great thing for a doctor to be able to do that. For we had so many cases. I know we had a neighbor that broke his leg halfway from his hip to his knee. Well, when they finally got it set, his foot turned right to a right angle. Well, they couldn't do anything different, and he could knit that way, and that's the way he always had to walk the rest of his life. I don't remember particularly the old remedies, but very often there'd be a fellow drive into yard that would have a remedy selling something that would cure anything. Home remedies and so forth. And then our mothers always had something mixed up with molasses and so forth, so we'd take it that's supposed to help us, and we'd have something like that. But there was no definite arrangement about any medicine or anything.
As a young man, did you see grain and hay cut by a machine or by scythe?
Well, I saw a lot of everything cut by with scythes. Back, you know, in the, well, I can remember back over 85 years, it was a man that could use a hand scythe in great shape was in great demand. And it wasn't very long till they had some sort of an old arrangement for a mowing machine. But for years, they used to cut the grain by hand because these old machines would knock the grain all off. And back in those days, they raised a lot of buckwheat. Well, that always had to be cut by hand. It had to be cut in the night, early morning, while the dew was on, so it wouldn't all shell off. And men who could go out and use a hand scythe in good shape were in great demand. But along came the binders and so forth, so they took care of the grain. And the hay, of course, was easy to cut when they got machines. But a man with an expert with a hand scythe was booked ahead.
When did electricity come to the farm, and how did this affect farming operations?
Well, in the early 90s, we commenced to get electricity out in the country, some here, and then the rural electrification business comes in. But I can remember in our home there that in 1902 was the first time the electricity got up the North Road as far as our home. And I remember what a great thing it was when we got that, and then all of these lamps were piled away. But it was a great thing, and it saved a lot of danger of fires, too, because we were always running around nights and going and milking a lot of cows with hay and straw scattered around with these old lanterns, and you upset one and something would get a fire. But it did away with a lot of that. And as I recall it, one of the things that would induce the farmer to put in electricity when it was available was the insurance people advocated, and they would cut the rates some.
When did the riding horse hoe and cultivator replace the hand hoe as the basic weeding tool?
Well, I think, as I recall it, that was in about 1900. The foundry had developed an arrangement that you could put horse hoes under and ride, and then, of course, they came across and made one with a two-row thing. It was a great thing. But the wheel cultivator was one of the greatest things, and I think we got the first of them about 1900. And that way we'd go along and we could tear the sides off of the row and knock it down, then go along with the horse hoe and put it back. And in that way we'd kill a lot of the grass, and that saved an awful lot of hand hoeing. Hand hoeing was a very hard thing to get done. But, of course, as the potato industry grew, of course, the various machines that were needed were developed and came along. But it was interesting, one thing that did away with an awful lot of grass was one of the great inventions we got was when we got a disc harrow. And the disc harrow was a thing that was going to cut the sod and cut the ground up so that the weeds were left kind of out of it. And they ground the dirt up so that it saved an awful lot of work afterwards. That was a great invention, the disc harrow. And that came along, I would think it was about 1910 that we got our first ones.
What was Albert A. Burley's part in bringing the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad to Houlton?
Well, Albert A. Burley was really the promoter of the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad. He got a man by the name of Cram in Bangor, who had had some railroad experience, to work with him. Well, then Albert A. Burley had an awful lot of timberland, and he put that up is collateral on big loan that he turned over to get the railroad started. And he got Houlton and a few towns to put in some money. But Albert A. Burley was really responsible for the thing. Well, then they got enough guarantees and so forth. Well, then the thing was to get the railroad laid out. Well, you got Moses Burpees to come here, and he was the chief engineer and laid the railroad out from Bangor clear through to Fort Kent. And he did a wonderful job. And then they got it all laid out and everything like that. Then they let the contract for the whole thing to a company by the name of C.P. Treat. And they had their headquarters in Houlton. They'd be about in the middle of the whole performance. And they were an awful nice crowd. I remember them well. Well, then they let part of that job to a firm by the name of Johnson from out in Chicago. And they came here and they built part of the road under Treat. And then when they got to be going north of here, why, there was Charles and Mike Murray, who were Italians, and they had a drove of Italians to help them. They took their contract to build from here up north. And in those days, it was all done by shovels, and the only thing that they had to move dirt was mules. But there was no equipment like they have now at all. I don't know if I put that down.
What can you tell me about the history of the Unitarian Church in Holton?
Well, the Unitarian Church, I can remember it very well. Back, well, I was just 5 or 6 years old when they left there. And it was on North Street, right where Harry Stewart lives now. And my grandfather gave the Unitarian Society a lease of that land for a church. And if the church was ever burned or discontinued, the land reverted to my grandfather. Well, that went along for years and years. Finally, there was a fire there in it, damaged it quite a lot. Well, then there was a movement on, and a lot of them wanted it over town, and they built a Unitarian church right where Broadway is now. And that was a very good church, too, and, well, everything went good there. Well, then along came the big fire, and, of course, that was burned. Well, then they bought the corner lot right from R.W. Shaw, from right where the present Unitarian Church is, and that was built there. And I well remember we had a building committee then, and a man by the name of R.L. Turney was chairman of that building committee, and he'd been out to California, and he had seen a church like ours out there with that roof, kind of a roof. Well, he came back and he showed that to the other men in there, and they were all opposed to it because we knew that that roof in this it was all right in California where they have rain once in a while, but would be very poor investment for here on account of the snowstorms and so forth. But Mr. Turney was a very determined man, and the other two men who had been authorized to build the church agreed with him, and they went right ahead and built it. Well, consequently, I remember so well, for I was chairman of the board of trustees there for quite a number of years, and about every snowstorm we'd have to dig up some fellow that would go up onto that roof and shovel it off. Well, it kept going on, it kept leaking worse. Well, then finally we put on another roof, and that helped some. Well, then that got to leaking. Now the church has three roofs on it due to them building a California roof here for this climate. But it looks good, and everybody's very happy about it, and there's only two or three of us alive that, well, I don't know of anyone that's alive now that would remember all those meetings about that roof. I don't think there's anyone else would remember it at all. But anyway, we're very lucky to have it.
Is that all right?
Do you remember the names of some of the Unitarian ministers?
Well, of course, the first Unitarian minister I can remember was Mr. Crosby was a wonderful man, and he had been minister here on North Street, and then was for a while on the one on over town. Well, then after that, there was a man by the name of McElwain, and we've had various ministers. Then Mr. Cook, I don't know. There's been so many, I'd have to sit down to figure them out, but we've had a lot of them. And some built the church up and some, well, kept it going. That's the way it goes. We're very fortunate at the present time that we have a wonderful young man who's doing a good job. But in the past, we've had one thing that we made a mistake of at times. We would get a man who was within 2 or 3 years of his retirement. Well, his desire to increase had kind of gone by, but since we've had younger men who wanted to make a showing and so forth, we've been very successful, and we're very, very fortunate in the man we have at the present time.
Is that all right?
This was the town of Houghton. Boys and girls had gone to Rica for years and years, and it developed along in the late 90s that over 80% of the income at Rica was from the Houghton pupils. In those days, Rica was one of four Baptist fitting schools for Colby College. And no reflection whatsoever on the Baptist church here. There'd been no trouble whatsoever. But it was the ministers, and a minister that they had back in the 90s, he really ran the Rica, and a Rica having a school committee and paying over 80% of the income for Rica. A lot of the townspeople, led by Don Powers, felt that Rica should at least, Houghton, should at least have one member of the board. Well, I remember this as well as though it was yesterday. This was back in 98. Well, the Baptists were agreeable to it, but the Baptist minister opposed it. And he stood on French's Corner one day and remarked to four or five men there that the town of Houghton needn't think they were going to run Rica. Well, Don Powers was one of those that was quite disgusted with Rica, with the courses they were given, especially botany and those things. And he heard that, and in 2 hours' time, he had a petition up to have a special town meeting. Well, why I remember this so well is they had the special town meeting, and I was one of those, I was a junior at that time in Mr. Felch's botany class. Well, Don had been awfully opposed to that, and he had Mr. Felch have his class at this town meeting. Well, we had the town meeting, and lo and behold, I was in class. When we got there, we sat down in the front of the audience there, and they started the town meeting. Well, Don Powers got up, and he made quite a speech about it. We were paying for a lot up there that wasn't helping us any. And now he says, here's this botany class. And he asked Mr. Felch to tell him just what they did. Well, Mr. Felch got up and told him that we studied flowers and so forth and pressed them and all of that. And then about every third week during the summer, we'd have a field day. And we'd go out, and the boys would pick flowers, and the girls would press them, and the girls would take lunches. Well, there were six of us boys on the class, and we were as big then as we'd ever be. There was Jimmy Cox and myself and two Cassidy boys from Carrie and two other boys. We were all good size. We were as big as they'd ever be. And then Don asked the boys to stand up. I'll never forget this. We all stood up. And he'd say, well, now, he asked each one of us, if we had been out on that field day, a few days before that. And we said, yes. And I'll never forget if I lived to be 1,000 years old. Then he knew my name. He says, look, Fred, do you remember how many daisies you picked that day? Well, so that brought down the house. And he says, isn't your father digging potatoes? And I says, yes. Well, couldn't he have used you at home? I says, yes. And he asked each boy that. But I'll never forget. Then he ridiculed this daisy business. Now, here we are, he says, paying tuition. And that's what these big arc of boys here that ought to be helping their fathers are learning, is going out and picking daisies. Well, then he asked one of the Cassidy boys, he says, what do you eat when you go out? Well, he says, the girls take lunches. Well, he says to the boy, how'd you enjoy them? Oh, my God, I couldn't live on them. Well, now that Don says, there it goes. The boys should have been helping their father, and these girls that probably couldn't get up a meal to help their mother, but they're making little lunches that these boys would eat. Oh, say, what a meeting that was. Well, anyway, they voted to start the high school, and what a blow that was to Rick at that time. But they softened the blow some by having them vote that they wouldn't have a graduating class that year. So that they made it possible for us to stay and graduate from Ricker. That gave them another year. But I'll never forget how it sounded when he asked us, Cassidy, oh, my God. Oh, say, what? Those town meetings were funny. I wasn't.
Really?
Is this all connected?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, those town meetings were very funny events. I'll never forget. Back in the, this was a long time ago, the Orangemen were very strong at Woodstock, and they got quite an organization going here, and they felt that they should run a board of select men. Well, I was at Rick at that time. We were